You're listening to Medscape's In Discussion series on transthyretin amyloid cardiomyopathy, a podcast where thought leaders and clinical experts share their diverse insights and practical ideas for optimizing patient care. This series is hosted by Dr. Kevin Alexander, an advanced heart failure trained cardiologist and assistant professor of cardiovascular medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine. Relevant disclosures can be found with the episode show notes on Medscape.com or the Medscape app. The topics and discussions are planned, produced, and reviewed independently of advertisers. This podcast is intended only for use healthcare professionals.
Hello, I'm Dr. Kevin Alexander, a heart failure and transplant cardiologist at Stanford University. Welcome to Medscape's In Discussion series on ATTR-CM. Today, we'll discuss current and emerging therapies for ATTR-CM with our guest, Dr. Tony Ury. Dr. Ury is a board-certified cardiologist and associate professor of medicine at UC San Diego Health, where he serves as the medical director of both heart transplant and the cardiac amyloidosis program. Welcome to In Discussion, Dr. Ury.
Thank you.
So, Tony, to start, one question I've asked each person who's joined for the podcast is, if you weren't a heart failure transplant doc and amyloid expert, what would you be doing in life?
Oh, that's a good question. I think I would probably be doing, well, I shouldn't say I would be doing this. I'd be pursuing a career, probably a failed career in professional soccer. It's a passion of mine, but no chance that I would ever be successful in that.
Ah, nice. Awesome. Well, this is a pretty big topic and a lot to cover. So I'd like to jump in. There's been huge advances in our ability to treat patients with ATTR-CM. You and I have been in the field for some time now. We've seen a huge evolution in terms of what we can offer to patients. Now with three FDA-approved therapies for ATTR-CM, I wonder if you could just highlight a little bit about what the pathogenesis of ATTR is and how these therapeutic classes work.
We know that ATTR amyloidosis essentially is defined by tissue infiltration with this proteinaceous material or amyloid fibril. The TTR molecular protein is made predominantly in the liver. And because of different factors such as oxidative stress and those that are older and just normal aging, or maybe in a rare subset of patients, those that have a genetic mutation, which leads to destabilization of this TTR, the TTR will then essentially form into these amyloid fibrils when it disassociates from the stable configuration and forms monomers and misfolds. And then eventually this TTR protein or amyloid protein will then infiltrate tissue and cause things like heart failure. The therapeutic classes are really aimed at trying to disrupt this amyloidogenic cascade. And they work in different parts of this cascade. As we know, the origin is in the liver predominantly. So we have a class of drugs called silencers, or some people will describe them as knockdown, because they essentially will harness the messenger RNA pathway and disrupt formation of this TTR protein, thus taking away the precursor. And by doing so, it should halt or at least slow down progression of this disease. And if you contrast that with another class of drugs called the stabilizers, those work directly by binding the TTR protein in its stable configuration. And the way I like to think about it is that those drugs, the stabilizers, will lock the TTR protein in this stable configuration, again, blocking this downward cascade, which leads to disassociation, monomer formation, and then eventually amyloid fibril deposition into tissue.
I think what you highlighted is the fact that these therapies, in both cases, work on the production end of things. So decreasing in one way or the other, the potential for producing those toxic monomers that can go on to form the mature amyloid fibrils. So there's been three drugs that have been FDA approved for ATTR-CM based on pivotal phase 3 clinical trial results, the ATTR-ACT study, ATTRibute-CM, and Helios-B. Could you tell us a little bit about how those studies were designed and what they showed us?
Of course. And I think you and I have chatted about this before, but it's important to recognize that these trials were enrolling in different eras. So inherently, there's going to be populations that are very different. And it's also one of many reasons why we really shouldn't be comparing across different trials. The first trial was the ATTRACT trial that was published in 2018, and that was with a drug called tafamidis. And that one is a stabilizer. essentially those patients that were enrolled. And actually, the other upcoming trials that I'll mention also had very similar populations, at least entry criteria, had to have a diagnosis of TTR cardiomyopathy. Historically, we know that was determined by a biopsy. Later on, you'll see the allowance for non-invasive studies such as the nuclear pyrophosphate scan. But essentially, they had to have a diagnosis of TTR cardiomyopathy. They had to have had excluded light chain amyloidosis. And then they had to have either class 1 through 3 symptoms. Class 4 was excluded in actually all trials due to concern for late stage disease or also potentially futility in treating the patients that had what we consider to be end stage disease. The age in the ATTRACT trial was 18 to 90. The patients had to have an NT-proBNP of greater than 600. And essentially what we know is that those patients were then followed for an extended period of time. The primary outcome was all-cause mortality and cardiovascular hospitalization. And they used the Finkelstein-Schoenfeld method for that composite primary outcome, similar to what we saw in some of the upcoming trials that came later on. The next trial, I think that is similar in the sense that they used a drug with a mechanism very similar, a stabilizer, would be ATTRibute-CM. That one enrolled patients and were randomized patients to either acoramidis or placebo. And recognizing, of course, that this was in an era where tafamidis was already FDA approved and then approved by other agencies across the world, there was an allowance for tafamidis exposure or drop-in after 12 months. Patients had to, of course, get to the 12-month period before they could be given that therapy. And that was at the discretion of the providers that were managing them, not trial protocol. And I would say that the major difference, if you want to be nitpick a little bit, would be that the NT-proBNP criteria was lower. It was 300, but otherwise had very similar entry criteria with CKD stage 5 excluded in this trial. The primary endpoint was a win ratio that included all-cause mortality, cardiovascular hospitalization, change from baseline in NT-proBNP, the change from baseline in the 6-minute walk distance. And then the last one would be, of course, HELIOS-B, which is the third therapy that eventually was FDA approved. And patients were enrolled, and this is a silencer study, in contrast with the other two that were stabilizers, the primary endpoint being composite of all-cause mortality and recurrent cardiovascular events through 33 to 36 months. And that difference, 33 to 36, was because of a protocol change while the trial was being conducted.
So a lot to unpack there. I think some of the things you highlighted really important to reemphasize is one, that these trials were conducted over a rapidly evolving era of ATTR management in terms of increasing awareness, the utilization of non-invasive scintigraphy scans to identify patients, and clearly an overall trend of less sick patients over time. And this has been borne out as we look at the placebo groups among the trials and the decreasing event rates with each subsequent trial. As you nicely highlighted, each one of these trials was statistically significant in their primary endpoint. Each one included strong cardiovascular outcomes that we want to see in other heart failure or cardiovascular spaces and showed a high degree of efficacy. I think very convincing in what led to the approval of these and the availability of these therapeutic options. And given the challenge that we can't cross-trial or shouldn't cross-trial compare, and we have these three available therapies, there's heterogeneity in terms of how we can utilize these. And the ACC guidelines gives us some guidance, but really says that all three of these options are kind of first line or could be considered. In your practice, Tony, how do you approach, someone comes in newly diagnosed with ATTR-CM, how do you approach discussing these options? And do you have preferences, or give us a little insights in terms of how you ultimately decide what to put a patient on?
I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that also, because what I'm going to share is probably an opinion. And if we ask enough people, we'll have many others. I first of all state that all were successful trials and that all three will work. Of course, we have different analyses that have been done since the trials have been published and even part of the subgroup analysis. So there are encouraging signals that I'll see. And if I think about, well, a patient may fit this profile where they saw the most benefit, then sometimes I'll mention that because that may be a little bit easier for that patient to understand why I'm recommending one versus the other. And I'll be more clear what I mean by that. As you know, the acoramidis or the Attribute CM has a very high win ratio for the hereditary or variant population. And in subgroup analysis, there was a win ratio of 2.4. So in those that come in with V122I, I sometimes will mention that if the patient is unclear on which one they want to start, or if I think there may be a differentiator in terms of which one they should start. I also consider what other organ manifestation may be involved, because we mentioned the cardiac trials, but some of these therapies have been approved for hereditary neuropathy. And while I would not make an argument for most patients having a neuropathy, particularly the wild type, patients do present with varying degrees of extracardiac organ involvement, and that may be an opportunity to discuss which is dominant. And I'm speaking particularly to this wild type population that we've historically only thought about heart, and then everything else is kind of a bystander. In those patients that have neuropathy, maybe have some gastrointestinal symptoms, I will often mention that vutrisiran may be the right choice for them. And then lastly, compliance is a big issue. So there's adequate data, not just in the amyloid space, but in other therapies, that sometimes it's challenging to get patients to come back to the clinic or to take their meds. And the simplest one for me, because of a very favorable side effect profile, it works, would of course be tafamidis. It's one pill daily, doesn't require any lab monitoring. It doesn't require the addition of any supplemental vitamins, et cetera. And the patients will still derive benefits. So I consider all those things. Some patients already come with some idea of what they want, because as we know, the advocacy groups and patient facing material is quite extensive. So that's somewhat my approach. I would say there's no right or wrong answer based on the data, in my opinion, but sometimes patients want a discussion that's a bit more nuanced. I'm curious to hear what your approach is, if you have a standardized approach to their management.
Yeah, Tony, I think similarly, I have a non-standardized approach, meaning it really is patient by patient. And I think some of the upstream factors you highlighted, and I completely agree with, are that patient preference comes into place and adherence. So even just the simple difference, oral, you know, pill versus injection, and then the frequency, that those things carry weight, whether or not a patient has a preconceived or, you know, impression about what they would like is also important. And, you know, I think amyloid is a space where there is a lot of data and resources accessible to patients. And so patients oftentimes, like you said, have some idea of these therapies and may have some preferences. So those things, like, they play an important role. Patient copay and cost certainly are factors as well. If something's cost prohibitive and something else isn't, then that would carry a lot of weight. Because at the end of the day, like you said, all three of these therapies are clinically effective. And while there might be some differences, you know, let's say you theoretically did a head-to-head-to-head trial, sure, you might be able to show differences, but we don't have those data at this point. So it really are these kind of nuances that play an important role. I highlight as well the variant data for acoramidis. And so for certain subpopulations, that's something that, you know, I mentioned to patients and may lean things in that direction. And like you said, the neuropathy data today, we have the most for the silencers across different therapies, and we know they're highly effective. Not to say that stabilizers can't be effective in neuropathy. There haven't been recent trials looking at dedicated neuropathy populations for stabilizer. And so for folks that have some of the TTR variants where we know they have a decent burden of neuropathy, say V30M or T60A, you know, those would be the two more common ones in the U.S. If someone has a decent burden of clinical neuropathy, then I would lean towards a silencer in that case as well. Maybe that gets to my next question. You know, this is a controversial topic, so you probably can tell where I'm going with this, Tony. Maybe I can give you my answer before you answer this time. The role of combination therapy, now that we have multiple therapeutic classes available for ATTR without necessarily data to guide us on what the role of combination therapy is. I think when I have patients, I tell them just that we don't have data to show yet if there's a incremental or added benefit to being on two different therapeutic classes. And in general, I don't use combination therapy very often. Probably the most common scenario would be those mixed phenotype patients that have a lot of cardiomyopathy, have a lot of neuropathy, or some of those patients that have high risk features with ATTR-CM. So let's say a homozygous V122I patient that already has fairly advanced heart failure and they're younger and they're kind of heading towards transplant down the road. Anything that might help to extend that runway, I think about it there. But I'd like to see more data to help understand, one, is there a role for its more broader use and what patient populations that might be? And so curious what your thoughts are.
I would agree. I rarely use it. And I think to myself, what's the downside of using it? Which is a big consideration, the cost to the health system and to society. There really isn't a clear downside to using combo therapy. So when patients are asking me about that, it's a hard discussion at times to have. The data, as you point out, is very modest and does not necessarily show a signal for improved outcomes in combination therapy. I actually think there may be a signal with the upcoming trial for futility, because that'll be a bigger population with more exposure to stabilizer on top of silencer. That may give us a more definitive answer that it may not be the right thing. I don't think we quite understand this residual risk of amyloid, how the disease progresses, and if by adding a second agent, we're going to attenuate that risk, because I don't think that's actually been seen in the limited data that we have from HELIOS-B. But in the absence of a very aggressive genotype-phenotype combination, as you've pointed out, then I also have not routinely used it. And I say routinely because I must admit there are some patients that have been insistent or see multiple physicians and end up getting on combo therapy. And at that point, I don't think it's appropriate to put the patient in the middle and have different physicians, you know, debating how to treat the patient. At that point, I oblige and will continue dual therapy in those patients.
Yeah, makes sense. And you alluded to this a little bit, but the upcoming CardioTransform trial is an ongoing phase 3 clinical trial looking at eplontersen, another TTR silencer in the ATTR-CM population. The drug's currently approved for polyneuropathy, and we're awaiting the results of this phase 3, which is the largest ATTR-CM study to date. And like you pointed out, is expected to have a high proportion of patients on background tafamidis. So that might give us some further insights one way or the other about the effect of combination therapy. So everyone can stay tuned for that. I think in the last little bit, let's touch on some of the ongoing clinical trials, because they have different mechanisms of action, and they'll be entering this broader TTR landscape with multiple therapies approved and, you know, and people being on these background therapies in the trials. So I'm thinking about the TTR depleters, the monoclonal antibodies that are designed to potentially remove amyloid, and then gene editing with CRISPR-Cas9. So in some ways, a permanent silencer. What are your initial thoughts about those therapeutic classes?
The CRISPR-Cas9 is interesting because, as we've already alluded to or said, there is issues with compliance, and the one and done is attractive to, I think, many patients. The challenge, of course, is that the data, safety data, will need to follow for a number of years before I think there's comfort in using that type of therapy, particularly when you have therapies that have shown to be safe and are going to be available immediately or have very similar mechanism. I don't consider that to be a game changer. I think if it's positive, it'll be an alternative. The depleters I put in a different category as a potential game changer. And by harnessing the immune system for clearance of amyloid, then you could imagine that we may be able to be forgiven for missing amyloid and having a patient go through our health system and show up late. And hopefully that allows us to not just remove amyloid by imaging and by biomarkers, but also improve functional class, improve structural changes of the heart, and improve heart outcomes. That's what I'm most curious about. I'm fairly convinced that we're going to have a positive imaging biomarker study because it is, you know, activating complement. It is activating macrophage signaling to the myocardium. The question that I still have is, what is the price? Is there going to be more scar, more inflammatory changes? Is there going to be less improvement in the cardiac function and functional class because of a secondary process? And I think that's going to be of interest in the near future when these trials get to that point of being read out?
I share similar thoughts there with the depleters. As a mechanism of action, it's somewhat orthogonal to what we currently have, where our therapies mostly work on the production end. And so if a depleter is able to remove amyloid, it seems like a natural complement to these other therapeutic classes, particularly as you highlighted for later stage patients with more adverse remodeling related to amyloid. And compared to the stabilizer silencers, the potential safety of these, as well as the gene editing, like you mentioned, isn't necessarily going to be theoretically as benign, right? And so it'll be important to see, along with the efficacy of these therapies, what the safety profile is as well, because we've been kind of fortunate that the currently available therapies have very, very good safety profiles. And so that, I think, will factor into clinical decision-making as well. We've covered a lot in a short time, and you know, I'll highlight some of my thoughts from this. So we're in a renaissance of ATTR disease-modifying therapies. In the last 6 years or so, three FDA-approved therapies for ATTR-CM, a phase 3 clinical trial that could report out later this year. And so we're entering a time where we have very effective options for patients that can reduce hospitalizations, stabilize quality of life, and improve survival. We don't have comparative data among these therapies, and so it really takes a individualized approach to determine what's the best treatment plan for the patient. And to me, that's part of the fun of the amyloid space, is that you really do have to know your patients well and take the time for those conversations. And one of the things that we kind of touched on, but I want to just emphasize, is the importance of diagnosing patients earlier. You know, another podcast, we talked about detection of amyloidosis with imaging modalities and increasing awareness. It's clear for any of these therapies that we currently have that they work better for earlier stages of disease. And so even delays of diagnosis of months now, we're starting to learn from these trials, could have implications on long-term outcomes. So in parallel with these available therapies, making sure that we diagnose patients as soon as possible is going to be imperative. And the future looks bright in terms of the clinical trials that we have ongoing, looking at some novel mechanisms of action. And so we'll see how those therapies may complement what we currently have or add on to what we have as options. To wrap up, today we've talked with Dr. Urey about current and emerging therapies for ATTR-CM. Thank you very much for joining us. This is Kevin Alexander for In Discussion.
Thanks for listening to Medscape's In Discussion Transthyretin Amyloid Cardiomyopathy podcast series with our host, Dr. Kevin Alexander. Be sure to look for more In Discussion episodes wherever you get your podcasts. Check out Medscape.com or the Medscape app for show notes, links, and more information on transthyretin amyloid cardiomyopathy.